I work and get paid like minimum wage. Sights to hit the clock by the end of the day. Hop from downtown into the hood where I stay. The only place I can't afford because my block ain't safe. I spend most of my time working.
Welcome to Off Kilter, the show about poverty, inequality, and everything they intersect with, powered by the Center for American Progress Action Fund. I'm Rebecca Vallis. This week, Off Kilter broadcast from CAPS Ideas Conference, aka the CPAC of the left. So we bring you a couple of the conversations that Jeremy, the Slevenator, and I had with progressive leaders who spoke there, including New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio, who has championed the right to counsel for low-income tenants facing eviction, and who made some news this week on marijuana enforcement reform. Also, Congressman Ted Lieu on how to walk and chew gum at the same time as we fight to address widespread economic challenges, even as we fight to save our very democracy. And then, switching gears a bit, with House Republicans' draconian farm bill scheduled to hit the House floor for a vote later this week, I talk with Congresswoman Rosa DeLauro, one of the Democrats in Congress fighting to kill the bill, which would take food assistance away from 2 million Americans. But first, Jeremy Slevin, the Slevinator. We took a break at the Ideas Conference in between sessions and cut class. I sort of feel like we're cutting class right now.
Yeah, we've been cutting class all day. Don't tell anyone.
I was listening to some of this stuff.
Oh, me too.
But we had things to do.
But we've been cutting class regularly.
We've been cutting class to have hard-hitting conversations with newsmakers about the issues that matter most. I'm nauseating myself. all right. Anyway, so you're knocking the microphone off.
Well, if Bill de Blasio did it, I figured I can kick the microphone.
Slevs, I can't take you anywhere. Also, you're right. Bill de Blasio did it. So I think you're fine. So we're hanging out at the Ideas Conference, but I figured this week I would give away the day we were taping so that you didn't have to.
This is now, I think it's catching on that we just spoil each episode with the day we're taping.
It's certainly something you do a lot. So if that's what defines catching on these days, I'll take it. Anyway, we wanted to do, and in case you missed it this week, because obviously a lot being talked about at the Ideas Conference, we'll get to all of that later in the show. But there's also a lot else going on this week.
A lot going on in the real world.
And for starters, yet again, it seems to be Infrastructure Week.
Of course, we should be celebrating because I can't believe it's been a year since the official Infrastructure Week, but it has been. This is officially Infrastructure Week.
But wait. Infrastructure Week like 14 times?
Apparently, Infrastructure Week is an actual thing that like the AFL-CIO and the Chamber of Congress designate each week.
So this is not one of the White House's Infrastructure Weeks. They've tried to have Infrastructure Week like 14 times.
Right. The joke is that they announce it's Infrastructure Week, and then there's some, of course, tweet or scandal that happens.
But of course, it's not a joke because what happened with Infrastructure Week this week, I felt like this was an Onion headline, but it's not, is it turns out that, oh my God, I'm spoiling the news. I should be letting you do this. This is
your
job.
That's okay. Well,
you want to give it, it's good.
The spoiler is they announced during Infrastructure Week or ahead of Infrastructure Week that their infrastructure plan is dead.
Yeah.
Of course, this was a core campaign promise of Donald Trump's. And even as recently as this year, the White House put forward an infrastructure plan. This comes after a tax plan cost
$1.5 billion. You can't actually say they came out with an infrastructure plan because what they came out with was glorious over formatted bullets, right? Over-formatted bullets is effectively what they came out with. But back to Infrastructure
really,
Week.
But they really, tweaked the margins. You know, when you get the font to, like, the 18-point font, double space, so it looks like you filled a whole page.
Yeah. Is that, you're recalling, like, sixth grade?
No, I never did that. I never do that with memos.
Definitely not how the things you write for me look.
No.
Hey, Rebecca, here are those 750 words you asked for that fill up a page that's 18-point font with huge margins.
I just put a space in between each letter so it looks like more words.
But so on actual Infrastructure Week, the White House came out and said, just kidding, it's Infrastructure Week.
And the subtext here is it had actually been the kind of populist alt-right wing in the White House, the Steve Bannons, who had been pushing for an infrastructure plan to appeal to the, you know, white base. Bannon himself had said, I'm pushing for a $1 trillion infrastructure plan. Of course, the administration passed, signed into law, a $1.5 trillion tax plan. So they showed where their true priorities lie.
So happy No Infrastructure Week to you, yes. Jeremy. And instead, we can start talking about other things, I guess.
As our infrastructure crumbles unabated because the White House isn't doing it.
As our segment crumbles because, oh no, just kidding, it's not crumbling yet. You still have more.
Much more.
Why don't we just had Mother's Day.
Yes.
And there's a couple of things that have emerged since Mother's Day. Also, by the way, happy Mother's Day to my mom and my grandma, who I was really fortunate to get to be with over this weekend. Are you waving at them?
Yeah.
Hi, Mom. Hi, Grandma. Also, Jeremy's waving at you, too. And I love them very much. And so happy Mother's Day to all the mothers. Also, happy Mother's Day to people who are not mothers. And also, what is the news here, Jeremy? Help me. I'm flailing. I'm okay. Trying to fill time, and you're not stepping in and saying anything.
We have plenty to talk about.
I was filling time till you started
Mother's
emerging
Day to
with
the,
a headline.
All the mothers, on a not as encouraging note, a lot of news came out around Mother's Day on just how much many mothers struggle. For example, there was a report in The Atlantic, reported on in The Atlantic, that single mothers in college, which is a very common phenomenon, spend about 9 hours a day on housework while they are also juggling schoolwork, in some cases low-wage labor as well. Of course, this is a shocking statistic, given that many people in college are also on food assistance or are in poverty. Is really an under-discussed phenomenon in this country.
So not exactly what gets talked about most of the time, yeah, when people are wishing others a happy Mother's Day, but a lot of struggling moms out there who are trying to put food on the table and who are actually also, some folks started to pay attention to this around Mother's Day, being targeted by the Farm Bill, which could get, as I mentioned, a vote as soon as this week in the House, because that bill specifically targets parents with kids, yep, who are over age six, as though caregiving obligations disappear after your kid magically turns six. I don't really know what that's about. But so lots of reasons why this is a really startling new piece of research.
Yeah. Another report from our own Rajani Frederick at the Center for American Progress talked about chasm disparity between black mothers and white mothers. According to her report, regardless of wealth or educational background, black mothers are 3 to 4 times more likely to die during or after childbirth. In the wealthiest country on earth, we still have sky high levels of not only infant mortality, but mortality of mothers.
I mean, there are a lot of reasons, there are a lot of things out there that I think we talk about on the show pretty regularly, yep, in a way where folks may even get somewhat inured to this, but yep, I feel like this is one of those topics where it's worth taking a step back, taking a deep breath, and just reflecting on the fact that we are the wealthiest nation in the world, yep, and yet we face maternal and infant mortality rates that look a lot more like the developing world than like our peer nations. And this is particularly the case for mothers of color. What a heartbreaking statistic.
Yes. And this is true of their children as well. Babies born to black mothers are twice as likely to die in infancy as their white, mm-hmm, non-Hispanic counterparts. And I'll add, we're recording in Washington, D.C., which has some of the wealthiest counties surrounding it. Nonetheless, D.C. has some of the highest infant mortality in the country.
Absolutely shameful, and something where we already know what it takes to, yeah, make sure that people are healthier. And it starts with access to health insurance, something that the administration and leaders, yeah, in Congress have reminded us yet again as recently, right, as this week. They're not done, yeah, trying to take away from tens of millions of, yeah, Americans.
Not only health insurance, but making sure we adequately fund housing assistance and food assistance, because these are all predictors of infant mortality.
That's exactly right. So going back to the farm bill for a second, because it's so much on my mind, and I know I can't stop talking about it, but I think that's what everyone should be feeling right now, particularly in this crunch time moment where we really do have an opportunity potentially to kill the this bill, as Rosa DeLauro will talk about later in the episode. There was an op-ed in USA Today that actually really deserves some kudos for telling the truth, but also for highlighting some pretty amazing contrasts. And it talks about Jared Kushner, but what does Jared Kushner have to do with the food stamp program?
So Jared Kushner, as many people know, has repeatedly failed to adequately disclose his financial ties that he was obligated to report as a member of the White House. He has had to update his financial disclosures at least 40 times.
40.
And that's not even including.
You see what I did with my hands? That was not a 4 and not a 0, but that's what I did for 40.
40.
Jeremy's got it.
40.
Right there.
And this
40.
Is apparently 41 and not 5.
Don't get Will started.
Producer Will.
Don't get Will started.
He has also had to add over 100 foreign contacts that he did not report. He has faced virtually no consequences. He's had his security clearance downgraded, but of course he has continued to be the point on everything from Middle East peace to infrastructure to you name it. One of the most heartless new policies of the proposed farm bill is to add, as we've talked about, these so-called work requirements.
Or to make them a lot harsher.
To make them a lot harsher. Additional work requirements on top of what already exists in SNAP. And what this does effectively is say, if you mess up your paperwork, you could lose your food stamps, which could be life or death. And this story highlights.
And it gets worse. You could lose your food stamps for a year just for screwing up your paperwork. Yep. And fact, if you do it twice, you could lose your food stamps for 3 years. So the point the piece makes, right, is if Jared Kushner were in the position of needing to access the food stamp program and he'd made even one of the errors he's made 40 that we know of and that you just described, he'd be in the position of maybe never having food for the rest of his life at that rate.
Yeah. And I want to highlight the story they mentioned of Matthew Cortland, who also wrote for Talk Poverty, a blog powered by the Center for American Progress, who has chronic incurable bowel disease. And because they did not ask to include his middle name on the form he filled out, he was unable to get food assistance, basically putting his life at risk.
And part of what makes Matt's story so unbelievable and yet so believable for folks who know how hard these programs can be to access is he's a lawyer.
Yeah.
He's trained as a lawyer. Yeah. And so the title of the piece, deservingly so, is, or is it deservedly? I'm not sure. It's one of the two. Someone will tweet me about this, is you shouldn't have to be a lawyer to get food assistance. And yet that's the way the program already operates. Right. House Republicans are trying to make this even more the case in ways that it would massively backfire for them and their friends if they actually came into contact with these kinds of policies in their world. So hat tip and kudos to LOL GOP for that fabulous USA Today op-ed, and also to Medicaid Matt, as he's known on Twitter, who is very much worth a follow, at Matt BC, M-A-T-T-B-C, and we'll have his fabulous and really powerful and really terrifying essay at Talk Poverty on our nerdy syllabus page. We had more to talk about, Jeremy, but Will is really angry at us and is like wildly gesticulating that we have to end. I don't know where we'll end up. Somewhere we'll find out. But I want to just say that Jeremy, you are someone who week after week brings us the news, and this week it was a nice blend of good news and bad news.
That's an optimistic way to put it.
That's how I'm feeling. Don't go away. More Off Kilter after the break, including some of our interviews from the Ideas Conference.
You've got us 24 hours a day on your mobile smartphone via the Progressive Voices app. This is the Progressive Voices channel on TuneIn.
Rebecca Vallis here with Off Kilter, the show about poverty and inequality, and we're broadcasting live from the Ideas Conference that the Center for American Progress is hosting in Washington, D.C. I am so thrilled to speak with one of the people who just came off this stage, one of the progressive leaders who's here with us at the conference today, and that person, as you can see, is New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio. Mayor, thank you so much for being here.
I am thrilled to be here, Rebecca, and I want to thank you for having a show that focuses on inequality, which is the issue that is racking this nation, but not enough people are still talking about. So thank you for focusing on it.
And you are consistently one of those people who has talked about inequality. In fact, it was at the center of your platform when you were running for mayor.
Yeah.
Would love to hear you talk a little bit about some of the initiatives that you've championed since you were elected.
Well, I'll start by saying, you know, it's a classic thing they say in psychiatry, you can't solve a problem if you don't identify it first. You know, my message in the first election was we were living a tale of two cities and we had to do something very different. I've tried to bring that full circle going into my second term by saying our goal is to be the fairest big city in America and to look at all elements of our society and ask how can we make things more fair and more equal. And so that goes from everything from trying to get people better wages and benefits in their work to reducing the price of housing, creating more affordable housing, protecting affordable housing we have, and to something that is very near and dear to my heart. My number one initiative was to create pre-K for all the kids in New York City. Now that is a universal right. We basically added another grade to our public schools. We are doing the same now for three-year-olds. Mm-hmm. We call it 3K. We had pre-K, now 3K, and that will be universal in the next few years as well. And that really goes to the heart of inequality. You're literally talking now about a generation of kids who will all be at the same starting line educationally and a generation of families that will not have to pay for that privilege, which has been the great divider. So a lot more to do, but those are examples of trying to really across the board go at inequality in our city.
And we know, obviously, that high-quality education in those critical early years of life pays dividends later on in terms of kids' eventual educational outcomes, their employment outcomes. So a huge step in the right direction that also, as you point out, helps parents because they have a safe place for their kids to be so that they can be at work. But you mentioned housing, and we've talked a lot on Off Kilter about how we're in the middle of a national affordable housing crisis where in no state in this country, New York is unfortunately on this list as one of the states in this country, can a minimum wage worker earning $7.25 an hour afford even a one-bedroom apartment at market rent. Your administration in New York has taken on the issue of housing in a creative way, but a big part of it has to do with recognizing that folks often face a stacked deck if they're facing eviction and they don't have a lawyer.
Well, look, when we looked at this problem, and you're exactly right, you start with an equation that is backwards to begin with, a huge number of people not making enough money to live in their own city. This is happening all over the country. That, unfortunately, also comes with an incentive to a lot of the wrong kind of landlords, those who are unscrupulous, who are not the majority but are still numerous enough, to force people out and open up those spaces to those who could pay more. We recognize this becoming an epidemic problem in the city, so we decided to do something bold, working with our city council, and provide access to counsel for all New Yorkers facing eviction. And what it means is if you make $50,000 or less, you get a free lawyer. If you make more than $50,000, you still have access to legal advice and support. It is having a huge impact. As this program has been built out, evictions are down 27% already in the last few years. We're reaching tens of thousands of people with legal services. And look, it also changes dynamic. If you got an unscrupulous landlord, they think they can get away with an eviction, you know, they're going to go for it, sadly. But if more and more the word is, you know, the tenant's going to have a lawyer, it has a great preventative impact as well. That's one of a bunch of things we've done. We're mandating affordable housing and the creation of new development wherever there's a need for a city permit. We say you could have the permit if you guarantee affordable housing on a substantial scale. We are making sure that there's been a rent freeze or in low rent increase levels over the last few years for folks who are in regulated housing. A lot of things that just get to the basic reality of a society that's not affordable for working people. And if you add them up, it really has changed ultimately hundreds of thousands of lives. We got to do even more now going forward.
I think folks who maybe watch, we've got mic issues there. Sorry,
I'm too
folks.
Big for this table.
Your powerful words are
right.
knocking,
See,
the,
knocking
mic
over
right
the microphone
off, right off the table. I'll hold it up. That's
right.
Teamwork here.
Teamwork.
You were just talking about how so many folks don't have lawyers when they head into the courtroom. And I think a lot of folks who maybe watch Law and Order or they're familiar with criminal courts, they go, oh, wait, don't people have a right to a lawyer? Well, not in civil cases.
Not, right.
And that's why it's such a big deal what you guys have done to say, no, we're going to change that, and we're going to do that here at the local level.
Yeah, when you think about it, this is not like some small claims court. And, you know, housing court is basically you're either going to have a place to live or you're not. If you don't have a lawyer and you lose, you could end up literally homeless.
That's right.
And in shelter. That apartment that you're forced to leave will probably never be affordable again to anyone. But for families that stay in that apartment, it's probably going to be affordable for the longer term. And that's good for everyone, right? Mm-hmm. It was amazing to me when I finally saw from my team just how big an impact this would make. To recognize how virtuous what is a really small investment in the scheme of things is, because you know you can try and build more affordable housing, and you can do a certain amount of that, but it's a hell of a lot more humane and efficient to mm-hmm. keep people in the housing they have, mm-hmm. and that cost to that lawyer is pretty small in the scheme of things.
That's exactly right, and I want to let the number that you shared before sink in with folks, because having evictions down 27%
yep.
in New York City is huge. It's absolutely huge. So congratulations on that.
Thank
and
you.
Here's my call to other cities to do what you guys are doing.
Well, Newark just did. I was just with the mayor of Newark, Ross Baraka,
yeah.
and they're taking the same approach and applying it there, and I think mayors like to nobly borrow from each other. Sometimes we steal, but we ask permission first, you know, the good ideas and apply them. And I think this is an idea can work in a lot of different places because that same pressure on housing, that's happening all over the country.
It is. So I want to shift course just a little bit because you were just on stage talking a lot about how mayors like yourself are faring in the Trump era and what you guys are doing to continue to move forward progressive priorities in the face of a reactionary agenda that risks setting us back probably 50 years, centuries in some cases, in terms of people's rights and civil liberties.
Well, and part of the reality is that we at the local level have to not just resist, but blow by that agenda. And I can tell you from the perspective of New York City, and you know, we have a very strong local government, we have some real resources, but most of what's happened in the Trump administration has not stood in our way. There's been threats, but we have stood up to those threats, and the classic bully dynamic, if you stand up to the threat, sometimes they go away. That's what we found. It's really incumbent upon progressives to keep moving forward at the local level. That counts for an immense amount. If you create a new standard locally in enough places, it deeply affects the national reality. And I think there's sometimes a bit of a feeling of powerlessness because it's natural we all have a reference point to Washington and what the national government does. I think that's a little bit dated. The national government's been paralyzed for a long time. Trump is bellicose and negative, but a lot of his agenda can't move either because the national government is paralyzed. But meanwhile, there's tremendous creative capacity at the local level. And just the things I've talked about, we never had to turn to Washington to achieve pre-K for all our kids or to come up with affordable housing rules that were fair for our city. Or most of the big initiatives, neighborhood policing, you know, we've instituted to create a fairer relationship between police and community. There was nothing Washington could do to stop that. In the past, there really hasn't been a much necessarily that Washington would have done to help it either for quite a while. You'd have to go back several decades. I think we need to recognize that we're on our own and that's not all bad at the local level. And create relentlessly and set the bar higher and help each other to be more audacious. I think my message to progressives is, you know, don't undercount what we're capable of. Mm-hmm. You know, don't talk ourselves out of our own power. Like, see the possibilities and go relentlessly for them. And in New York City, that's worked. You know, every time we achieve something, we don't say, let's go home now. We say, what's the next thing we can achieve?
So I would love to give you the opportunity to also share some news that you just broke
sure.
here at CAPS Ideas Conference, and it has to do with criminal justice reform and also marijuana.
Yeah, what I talked about today was neighborhood policing in general and how we're trying to create a better bond between police and community, which we find to be not only more a matter of fairness and an effective policy for fairness, but also helps us to drive down crime. But where there still are some obvious disparities that we have to address is in the area of marijuana enforcement. So I announced that the NYPD in the next 30 days will revise its marijuana policies, will overhaul them and reform them, because we want to avoid any disparity in the way neighborhoods are policed. We do not want a situation where one community feels over-policed and another one feels policed properly, that's not the right way to do things. We want to end those disparities. We do not want unnecessary arrests. One of the things that we did in this administration was we ended arrests for low-level marijuana possession. We want to make sure that that is applied very consistently and that in other instances where arrests can be avoided, it's not the go-to it maybe was presumed to be in the past. I always say we've got crime down 4 years in a row, 100,000 fewer arrests in 2017 than in 2013. It's a different type of policing. It works and simultaneously improves relationship with the community, but we've got to do better on the question of marijuana.
And in the last couple of minutes that I have with you, I'm going to apologize but not apologize
okay,
for asking
like
this
that.
Question because I'm curious what you're going to say. What is it like being a New Yorker when we know it's New York that gave us Trump?
It's painful. There is something very real about that point. I don't think it's about the people of New York. I think the people of New York are wonderful, and obviously one of the places that most opposes the policies of Donald Trump. But there's something about the New York political and media culture that is a problem. I mean, let's be clear, that tabloid culture, which I think is very outdated, but still around. I mean, that's what bred Donald Trump. Mm-hmm. And it was a child of the blaring headline. New York's such a progressive place in so many ways and such a humane place and a city where, you know, all sorts of different cultures come together in relative harmony. There's so many things to love about it. But there has also been another side of New York that has been, you know, hyper profit focused and very materialistic and obviously too tabloid journalism oriented. Mm-hmm. All of that is the water that Trump swam in, and he learned a lot of bad lessons from all that, and he's, you know, applying them now. But the good news is it does not reflect the reality of most New Yorkers, and New Yorkers have been so strong in their opposition. I mean, a lot of the strongest resistance has come from New York. I'm very proud of that. And I said from the beginning we were going to challenge him on a whole host of issues. And I got to say, everyday people were right there with it. Mm-hmm. You know, some people in the media might have said, well, is it dangerous to the city's interest to take on the president? But everyday New Yorkers were quite clear that his policies could not be allowed to go unchallenged. And I got a lot of support from everyday people that it was the right thing to do to stand up to him.
Mayor, thank you so much for what you're doing to fight poverty, to fight inequality in New York City. I'm really excited to see other mayors, I'm looking at you mayors, take on what you have, especially when it comes to the right to counsel and housing cases and more. Mayor de Blasio of New York City, I don't have to tell you that. You know that because he's the guy. So thank you so much for taking some time.
Thanks for your wonderful show. Appreciate it.
Don't go away. More Off Kilter after the break. Jeremy Slevin's conversation with Congressman Ted Lieu at the Ideas Conference about how progressives can fight to address widespread economic challenges, even as we fight to save our very democracy.
Hi, I'm Gianna Garrel from Progressive Voices. Today, the angry roar of the conservative media machine dominates TV and radio, threatening to drown out and push out anyone who dares to discuss our progressive perspectives and ideals. But we can't let that happen. We have too many strong, smart, and important progressive voices who need to be heard. That's why here at PV, we're building a 21st century progressive media universe. One where all the best in progressive media can come together, rise above the static and the noise, and be heard by anyone, anywhere. And we need your help. We're in the middle of a critical campaign to make our dream of 21st century progressive media universe a reality. But we can't do it without grassroots support from people like you. Head over to progressivevoices.com to see how you can help. Please support this important progressive mission, because with your help, we can make sure all our progressive voices are heard.
Thank you for tuning in. We are live at CAPS Ideas Conference. I am Jeremy Slevin, filling in for the esteemed Rebecca Vallis, and I'm so honored to be joined now by Congressman Ted Lieu, Congressman from California's 33rd Congressional District. Thank you so much for joining me, Congressman. Yeah.
Thank you, Jeremy. Honored to be here.
Yeah, so you just got off of a great panel about basically the strength of our democracy. But I want to take it in a little different direction, because the tension in this panel was, while we need to make sure our democracy is not fundamentally at risk, a lot of people are still struggling. And the things people are tuning into day to day doesn't necessarily reflect what's going on in their lives. And even though the economy is on paper doing well, wages are stagnant and people are really struggling to get by. And so I want to start by asking you how you resolve the tension between focusing on this big threat to our rule of law and simultaneously communicating to your constituents that we're working to stop the real-life economic threats day-to-day.
Their national message from Democrats is on the economy, based on a better deal for the middle-class family, better wages, better skills, better jobs. And if people want to, in addition, talk about the assault on a rule of law, that's great. And we do have people doing that, including me. I think it's important to talk about both. But the main message from Democrats is on the economy. And even though we do have good unemployment numbers, we also had good unemployment numbers under Obama. Right. You had this huge reaction in the election of Donald Trump, because for a lot of those people who are currently employed, they're seeing their paychecks remain stagnant, like you said. They're not seeing the fruits of the economy. And the Republican policies have actually made it worse. They passed this Republican tax law, of which 83% of the benefits go to the top 1% and to corporations. So we're making a point that Democrats have a better deal for you, not the raw deal that the Republicans are giving you.
Do you feel like that's breaking through? Do you feel like people understand what a threat the Trump administration is to their daily life?
Yes, because if you just look at what's happened since Donald Trump got elected, Democrats have flipped about 40 special elections. So let's just think about this for a moment. A Democrat won the U.S. Senate in Alabama, deep red state. We went into rural Wisconsin this year and flipped the state Senate district by 27 points. And then Conor Lamb had an amazing victory in western Pennsylvania, flipping that district by 20 points. So I think people understand what a threat the Trump administration is.
Yeah. I want to focus even more specifically. You, of course, served in the Air Force, are a veteran and have been a powerful voice for veterans. And one of the features, I think, great ironies of this administration, someone who campaigned, "I love the vets," and did honestly have support among veterans, has now turned around and passed or attempted to pass a piece of legislation that really, really harm veterans. And, you know, I'd start with the big picture. Do you think this administration is good for veterans?
I do not. You can just look at the most recent thing that happened when Donald Trump nominated his own doctor to be head of the VA, a person with zero qualifications to run the second largest federal agency in America. And that was a very disrespectful act to veterans. Donald Trump was basically putting this person in because he happened to be his own doctor, not because he thought he could do a good job for veterans. And then it turned out that he had all these scandals. They didn't do any due diligence on Ronnie Jackson. The president basically just stuck him in because he felt like it. That's not what you do if you really want to care about veterans. I happen to have the largest VA in my district, the West Los Angeles VA, and we've been working with stakeholders to make it better. It was dysfunctional for many decades, but Obama signed a law that I authored to put in a whole new master plan that at its full build out will allow about 1,200 veterans who are homeless to have housing.
And of course, veteran homelessness, a very serious issue. The Trump administration has not been friendly for affordable housing. Ben Carson, as recently as a few weeks ago, proposed legislation to triple the rent for low-income homeowners, which would affect veterans. What do you think, specifically when it comes to veterans, as an elected official, what Democrats can do to communicate to veterans that this guy's not on your side, that, you know, whether it's the healthcare law or the tax law, what can Democrats do?
There are great organizations like Vote Vets that do that every day. But in November, people will know, right? If you're a middle-class family and you don't see your paychecks increase, if you don't see your future getting any brighter, if you see your healthcare costs increasing, you're going to vote appropriately. And that's why the party who controls the White House generally loses seats in midterms, because it really doesn't matter what the president says by then. The voters will know. is your life better or not? And for many people in America, the answer is going to be no, because they see everybody else doing better except them. Because again, right, the GOP policies are favoring the super rich. And then in terms of the poor and veterans and homelessness, you see really an assault by the Trump administration on the poor. As you noted, you've got Ben Carson, you know, raising rents, and this so much irony in that, because he's also the same Ben Carson that ordered a $31,000 dining table for his office. And I think the voters are going to understand that in November.
That's a great point. Not lost on many people, and whether it's Ben Carson or whether it's Scott Pruitt, that the same people launching an assault on people's basic needs are in many cases benefiting themselves. I want to pick up on something you said about the tax law. Obviously, it's their biggest supposed legislative victory. The Koch brothers are spending millions of dollars to sell this law. Paul Ryan has said that, you know, if we are able to hold the House, even though I'm jumping ship, that the tax law is going to be the reason. Is it working? Is the tax law the great hope that they claim it is?
Not at all. You just have to look at the Conor Lamb victory. The Republicans actually, in the beginning few weeks, spent heavily advertising about the GOP tax law. And then in the second half of the campaign, they stopped because they realized that it wasn't moving the needle, because people in Conor Lamb's district could see from their paychecks.
Right.
It wasn't helping them.
Again, they could, reality has a way of getting in the way of
that's
rhetoric.
Right. And so the people understood that this Republican tax law was a massive giveaway to large corporations and the super rich. Basically, if you owned a lot of property and you wanted to have this massive exemption for your heirs, you get a benefit from the tax law. Most people don't have that. And so you have just things like that that really annoy your middle class ordinary voter. They're seeing all these benefits going to corporations and to the super rich. I'll give you another example. In states like New Jersey, New York, California, other large states, you have this deduction on your state and local taxes that are now capped.
Yeah.
But you know what's not capped? Corporations. They can have unlimited deductions on that issue. And again, that's very offensive to your ordinary voter.
Yeah. Yeah. I think the, as you mentioned, the fairness quality is, you know, even if people, as Paul Ryan say, get $1.50 in their paycheck, they're losing their health care, because of the individual mandate. Premiums are going to go up. And on the other hand, these corporations and these ultra-rich are getting all these benefits. I would be remiss if I didn't mention, because we focus a lot on inequality and people in poverty and low-income folks on this district, the House this week is scheduled to vote on a farm bill. Normally, I buy partisan right. bill. And this year, of course, Republicans proposed a bill that would take away food assistance from 2 million people, it's estimated. I want to hear your thoughts
right.
on this proposal and yeah. kind of where it fits in with the right. broader Trump agenda. Right.
It's deeply un-American. As a country, we've always taken the policy that we're not going to let people starve. We're not going to let children starve. We're not going to let women and men starve. And that's what food assistance is. But in addition to not letting people starve, it also helps agriculture. So if you're going to cut food assistance, if you're going to cut the SNAP program, make it harder to get, that's also going to affect a lot of these agricultural districts, because less of their products are going to be consumed. So it is just a really dumb idea all the way around.
Yeah. It's not only, as you point out, the people who are consuming the food, it's the people who are making the food, and it affects the whole system. Well, I think that's a somewhat depressing but important vote, important mention nonetheless to end on. Of course, if folks want to get engaged on the farm bill, we have launched a campaign, handsoffsnap.org. People can contact their members, because we are trying to stop this House vote. Congressman Ted Lieu, thank you so much for joining me, and we appreciate having you.
Thank you.
Don't go away. More Off Kilter after the break. I'm Rebecca Vallis.
You've got us 24 hours a day on your mobile smartphone via the Progressive Voices app. This is the Progressive Voices channel on TuneIn.
You're listening to Off Kilter. I'm Rebecca Vallis. As we speak, House Republicans' plan for mass starvation, aka their farm bill, is being debated in the House Rules Committee, setting it up for a vote that could come as soon as this Thursday or Friday. News reports indicate that House Agriculture Chair Mike Conaway is whipping feverishly because he doesn't have the votes yet to pass the bill, which Democrats are unified in opposing, which leaves him unable to lose many more than a dozen Republican votes. I spoke with one of the House Democrats leading the effort to kill the bill, Congresswoman Rosa DeLauro, who represents Connecticut's 3rd Congressional District. Congresswoman, thanks so much for joining the show.
I'm delighted to join you. Thank you. This is a critical issue that we're facing.
So for folks who are just catching up, there's a lot of talk this week about the farm bill, which, as I mentioned, may actually end up getting pushed to the House floor for a vote as soon as this week. We're talking now before that vote happens, if it happens. But for folks who are getting up to speed on what's in this farm bill and what it means for nutrition assistance, what's the overview of why you're so opposed to this bill?
Thank you. I mean, I thank you for the question. And let me just put it in context. Today, the biggest economic challenge of our time is that so many people who play by the rules, they're in jobs that do not pay them enough money to live on. We have seen wages not keeping up with the rising cost of health care, child care, housing, and in fact, families struggle to make ends meet and to put food on the table. This is a reality. There is hunger in the United States of America. And what the Donald Trump and the congressional Republicans' partisan farm bill would only exacerbate that problem. What they do is they betray working families and our most vulnerable. What it does, it would impose onerous requirements on up to 5 million people who get help from the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program. It's known as the food stamp program. The most incredible thing is they're going to cut SNAP benefits by more than $23 billion. $23 billion. And what that means is 1 million households, 2 million people will be directly kicked off the program. And as I mentioned, 5 million subject to onerous work requirements. Another couple of things that they do is they are going to cut $5 billion from individuals who could potentially, their families, be eligible for school meals. We're going to see almost 300,000 kids who are going to lose free school meals. You know, I have to think back on this, Rebecca, because I was in the Congress when Newt Gingrich wanted to cut the school lunch program. And you know, there is nothing else consistent. This part of this farm bill would cut off school lunches for kids all over the United States. It really is pretty outrageous and cruel, because there is a real hunger problem in the United States today. You've got over 15 million kids. Nearly 1 in 4 live in its heavy shadow. My district in Connecticut, you know, Connecticut is statistically the richest state in the nation. But 1 out of 7 in my 3rd congressional district does not know where their next meal is coming from. Now, people like to say it's food insecurity, but you know, Rebecca, we are talking about hunger. There is hunger not only in my state, but in every state in this nation, all over this country. And I'll just add one more thing here is before you want to go on, what they are talking about, and it sounds good. They want to say that people will need to work. But the proposal, it creates what they call state-run training programs that have not been evaluated. It will not meet the need of the number of people that they are going to throw off the food stamp program. It's not going to be for the number of people that they are going to jettison, that it would be impossible to scale up to enroll hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of new participants. So that we're going to look at where people are not going to have any way in which to access food. There isn't enough money to provide for adequate job training. And I know from being on the Appropriations Committee, those folks who talk about job training program, skills training program, they are the first ones who want to cut the funding in the 2019 budget for skills training and job training.
And of course, it's not just your opinion that they're not going to be able to scale up these programs. That's actually something that we've learned from the Congressional Budget Office, the nonpartisan CBO, which came out after evaluating this proposal and said, nope, we can tell you right now, we don't think that these state-run bureaucracies in the name of workforce development, as you just described, are going to be able to be up and running not only within the period of time that the legislation says they will be or should be, but actually even within 10 years of the legislation going into effect. So a lot of hand-waving there, not just in terms of the massive underfunding you describe, but even the fact of being able to get up and running the programs that Chairman Conaway on the Agriculture Committee, the architect of this bill, has claimed are the reasons people aren't going to lose nutrition assistance if they're, quote, willing to work or to undergo job training. But Congresswoman, you mentioned that you've been in Congress going back to the Gingrich years when we saw all kinds of proposals just like these in many ways starting to really gain traction in the halls of the modern Republican Party. We'd love to hear you talk a little bit about whether you feel that this particular farm bill is in keeping with that tradition and where we've seen Republicans head in recent years, or is this actually different in some way? Is this even perhaps more extreme?
Well, you know, you bring up an interesting point, because in my research on the food stamp program, what I found over the years, and I can go back to George McGovern, Bob Dole, Robert Kennedy, who took a bipartisan commission across the country, as did McGovern and Dole, to explore the issue of hunger in the United States. And they found that there was a serious problem of hunger in the United States, which was the genesis of the nutrition programs. And by the way, the school lunch program comes directly, this comes out of President Truman, when they were recruiting for World War II, they found that our recruits were undernourished, had malnutrition, etc. So we're in the beginning of the school lunch program. But these are programs that have been over the years supported by Democrats and Republicans, understanding that the scope of the problem was so big and such a challenge in the United States, and that we shouldn't have people in the United States, in a land of abundance, going hungry. And so we fought this battle in the 2008 Farm Bill. Then I was on the Conference Committee at that time. And you rarely get appropriators on conference committees. We're like an invasive species here. So I was there for the nutrition portion of it. Leader Pelosi asked me to do that. We were able to come together. That was the Northeast, the West Coast, the Mid-Atlantic states, to focus in on conservation, on specialty crops, that's fruits and vegetables, and on nutrition. And we were able at that time, again, we voted, and the part of the 2008 Farm Bill increased the benefits for food stamps, indexed the food stamp benefit to inflation, expanded the asset level so that people could own a bit more and still be eligible. So we came together. We have seen over the last several years a mean-spiritedness surrounding the nutrition programs, and that is really culminated in the bill we are seeing today. I can recall in the 2014 Farm Bill, where there was the attempt to separate out the nutrition program from the other farm programs, which was unheard of, because this was quite frankly, because our farmers rely on the food stamp program for people to purchase their products. So that what we were able to come together on that effort, though there was a $20 billion cut to the food stamps in the 2014 bill. But this is probably the most mean-spirited bill that I have seen. On the one hand, in terms of the people who are going to be hurt by the legislation, and you pointed out this notion that everybody is going to be able to get a job is just nonsense. And Center for American Progress is defined that as well as the Center on Budget and Policy priorities. So it's not just us speaking about this. This is for sure. But what is interesting is who are the beneficiaries of the farm bill?
Well, and I think that's exactly where we should go next, because we've talked a lot on this show over the course of the past several months about, obviously, the Republican tax plan, which overwhelmingly benefited the richest people in this country and wealthy corporations as well. Now we've got Republicans turning around and saying that they can't afford food assistance that provides people $1.40 per person per meal. That's effectively what they're saying in trying to cut the SNAP program in all the draconian ways that you just described. But there are actually some winners in this bill as well.
There's some very, very big winners. And, you know, just on 83% of the tax cuts went to the richest 1% of people in this nation, to millionaires, billionaires, and corporations. With a tax cut scam that was rigged by the president and the Republican Congress, rigged for the rich. So, and now let's take a look at the farm bill, and you will once again see that the farm bill is rigged for the rich. This is a consistent pattern. They can't help themselves in many ways. There will be, you're looking at the top 3% of farms, the wealthiest Americans and big agribusiness will get the biggest break. So the top 3% of farms receive 40% of all farm subsidies. And now we're going to see the benefits even more concentrated. One of the things that they have, several of the things that they have done are really, really quite interesting. Your viewers need to know that the food stamp program is means tested. You are, you know, poverty level or below the poverty level to be eligible for food stamps. You mentioned $1.40 a meal. Now, what we're going to look at here is, so there is a means test for the food stamp program. What the farm bill does in terms of the subsidies to the of agribusiness and farmers in the nation, what they will do is they are going to allow millionaires and billionaires to get the subsidies. They are going to eliminate means testing. So that they currently, people who are now making $900,000 and couples that are making $1.8 million per year are not eligible for farm subsidies. But that is going to change with this farm bill. What they're doing as well is they are going to make cousins, nieces, and nephews eligible for subsidies, where today only family members, siblings, adult children are eligible for subsidies. They are not going to, they're going to not limit subsidies to one person per farm. There are no work requirements for farm subsidy recipients. There's no limit on the number of partners who can receive subsidies. Under the current law, each member of a farm partnership is treated as a separate person when you look at the subsidy payment. So they are going to open that door. You can live in Manhattan and you can own a farm somewhere in the country. You never have to till the soil. You never have to put a plow in the field, and you can get a subsidy. It is outrageous when they are going to tell people who are poverty level or below, who get $1.40 per meal, that they are going to lose these benefits. And what's more, they are going to make sure that the food stamp program, most of the people are disabled, they are seniors, or they are children. And most work, and some that don't work are doing it for medical reasons. They are going to tell folks you have to work for whatever. But there aren't any work requirements attached to those who get subsidies, who are off the land. There are no asset limitations. There are no income thresholds. And the second point I would make on this is with regard to the crop insurance.
So tightening the screws massively on...
This bill continues to provide $1.5 billion in subsidies to crop insurance agents. And the crop insurance companies are guaranteed a 14% rate of return. And most of these folks are, not even in the U.S. They are subsidiaries of foreign corporations. It is obscene what this farm bill does, which is why all the Democrats have opposed it in committee, and all Democrats will not support it on the floor of the House. And the Republicans and Donald Trump have put together a partisan farm bill that only won in committee on a party line vote.
So lots of similarities there between the tax law and actually this bill, which doesn't just tighten the screws on people who need food assistance, but it's actually making, as you describe, farm subsidies easier to access for some of the people who are some of the richest in sort of big ag, as it's often called. In the last minute or so that I have with you, Congresswoman, I just a candid question. I'm curious what it's like to be in Congress right now as a Democrat and as one of the most progressive Democrats that we have in either chamber of Congress, when you are working day to day with people who are literally lying to your face and to the faces of their constituents on a basis that I think we maybe have never seen before in modern politics.
Well, you know, Rebecca, fundamentally, what I believe is about government and its ability to provide opportunity for people. This is about where our values are. A shared value that there's not every man or woman for himself or herself. We are accountable to one another. We have a social responsibility. We have a moral responsibility to be there for when people are in need. All of those fundamental values are not present in this Congress. And every single day, what you can't do is you can't get tired. You cannot get frustrated. You have to keep going because your stakes are very high for the people of this nation. The way I describe this the fight that we are having is for the soul of our country, for the values that have made this country great. Because what Donald Trump and the congressional Republicans are doing is hollowing out the federal agencies, and in this particular point of view, the Department of Agriculture, and its ability to provide services to the people in this country, and these services are when they need it. So we need to double our efforts, redouble our efforts, and make the fight, because we have to win back the soul of this country for the people here. It's not about members of Congress. We'll do fine. We are going to do fine. But it's going to be about the millions of people who are going to be finding themselves without any recourse, with regard in this instance, to food or the ability to take care of your families. That's not who we are as a nation.
Congresswoman DeLauro is the congresswoman from the 3rd District of Connecticut. She is, as I said, one of the fiercest defenders of SNAP out there. Congresswoman, thank you so much for what you're doing to kill this bill, to make sure that families have enough to eat, and for taking the time to come on the show.
Thank you so much, and thank you for getting the word out. This is critical. Really very, very critical to the issue of hunger in America. There shouldn't be anyone in this land of abundance who goes to bed hungry or not, particularly our children. And that's what will happen if this bill passes. Thank you.
And that does it for this week's episode of Off Kilter, powered by the Center for American Progress Action Fund. I'm your host, Rebecca Vallis. The show is produced by Will Urquhart and David Ballard. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at Off Kilter Show, and you can find us on the airwaves on the Progressive Voices Network and the We Act Radio Network, or anytime as a podcast on iTunes. See you next week.
I want freedom. Freedom. But it's calling me back. I feel my spirit is revealing the map. We just trying to get freedom.